Iran unveils a new missile city with cruise and ballistic missiles and electronic warfare equipment. The UK High Court's documents show video footage of the 2011 massacre of an Afghan family by British forces has gone missing. And the Chinese capital Beijing is covered in thick dust with pollution levels surging off the charts as the worst sandstorm in a decade descended on the city. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has revealed a new underground missile facility in a fresh show of its naval forces capabilities. At a ceremony attended by the IRGC's commander, the force displayed a depot of ballistic and cruise missiles of different ranges. New missile systems and electronic warfare equipment were also delivered to the IRGC naval force during the ceremony. The systems have new operational features, including 360-degree firing and targeting on the move. Precise strike from underground is also another feature of the new systems. The IRGC commander, Major General Hossein Salami, said the new systems are a fraction of what he called the force's vast capabilities. Political commentator Sam Mahdi-Torabi says the new missile city displays Iran's might as the U.S. sticks to its all-options-on-the-table policy against the Islamic Republic.
Actually, this is a continuation of the enhancement and the improvement of Iran's strategic deterrence capabilities. In this case, as it relates to the naval power that Iran has and the ability to counteract any sort of attack that would come from the sea and from the ocean. And, of course, obviously, the whole point of all this and strategic deterrence is to make the Americans and whoever else understand that an attack on Iran would be fatal and that it is actually not an option that's on the table. Contrary to what's been said over the years that all options are on the table, actually all options are not on the table. This is something that maybe those on the inside knew years ago, and that's why they were desperate to have negotiations with Iran. Again, contrary to the way it's portrayed, it was never Iran that was desperate to have negotiations, it was always the West that was desperate. And so this is just, showing what the realities have been. And, of course, now with the fact that the whole attempt by certain elites, whether in Iran or in the West, to come to a strategic rapprochement has failed, with the failure of the whole JCPOA process, this is simply moving on to, from that, and Iran moving on and increasing its strategic power and realizing or showing to the West that it has many other options. It doesn't need to come to some agreement with the West.
The Iranian foreign minister has once again called on the United States to move fast with regard to saving the 2015 nuclear deal. Mohammad Javad Zarif calls the JCPOA the best possible deal that could ever be reached.
The United States has to come clean. We will not play with the future of our nation. U.S. needs to come clean. U.S. cannot play with us. We are serious negotiators, but when we agree to something, we stick to it. And we have shown that. We have an agreement. I can tell you one thing. This administration, the next administration, will not be able to do a better deal with Iran. Not with this government, not with any future government. This was the best deal possible. I believe what is important from an Iranian perspective.
Zarif was addressing a virtual conversation organized by the European Policy Center. He said that Iran needs serious trust in the ability of Europe and the U.S. to speak to their commitments. He said the Iranian nation has otherwise learned how to insulate the economy from oil and how to immunize it from coercion. He said the administration of President Joe Biden has done nothing new, rather recently threatening to block Iranian assets in South Korea. The top diplomat reiterated that the JCPOA was the outcome of years of intense negotiations and does not need any change. So you've said the deal, as emphasized by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, was a test which the U.S. failed by pulling out of it in 2018. Iranian COVID vaccine has kicked off its second and third human trial phases simultaneously. This is Iran is scrambling to get a viable vaccine to the market before the fourth wave of the virus hits the country. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Among the eight viable vaccine candidates in Iran, Kovirwan is inching closer to the market. Produced by the headquarters for executing Imam Khomeini's order, Kovirwan kickstarted the second and third human trial phases at the same time on Monday. Volunteers say they feel proud to be part of this great endeavor for humanity.
I'm so happy to take part in this great event and project. And if I go back to the moment of being volunteer for this project, definitely I would choose that without doubt.
I can't express how happy I am to be part of this valuable initiative. I should thank Kovirwan for letting me play a part in the trials.
The vaccine wrapped up its first phase a month ago. Phase one sought to test whether or not the vaccine is safe to be injected to everyone. Now the second phase will assess the efficacy of the vaccine against the virus.
And in this phase, we are going to have the effectiveness in 400, actually, 350, the 18 to 50, the age, and 100 will be 50 to 75. And in third phase, we are going to have in 20,000 people in some, you know, it's multi center in some of the provinces of Iran, not only in Tehran.
As the coronavirus keeps mutating to more lethal forms, Kovirwan experts are certain that the Iranian vaccine is effective, at least against the British version of the virus.
We exposed blood samples from our vaccinated population to UK variant of the virus, and the lab results showed that the virus was neutralized. We will conduct similar tests on other variants as well.
Iran is working on seven other homegrown vaccines, including Covfars, which is now undergoing the first phase of the human trials. This as the country has already started mass vaccination, mainly using Russia's Sputnik V.
The question of how much immunity Kovirwan will make will only be answered once the second stage is over. Meanwhile, its developers say they've already kicked off the mass production of the vaccine to catch up with the country's plan to base its national inoculation program on a domestic vaccine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A video showing the 2011 massacre of an Afghan family by special forces units of the British Army has gone missing. That's according to a media report citing a court document. The case was filed at the UK High Court by Saifullah Yar, then in his 20s, when four of his family members were shot dead. The case heightened concerns that British forces were massacring civilians with no connection to the Taliban. The video of the raid was captured by the U.S. military. But according to the Sunday Times, American authorities mysteriously lost the footage. It is not the first time key evidence of a deadly raid goes missing. UK investigators tasked with probing war crimes in 2017 found that British operators doctored reports on dozens of such raids between 2011 and 2013. London police's heavy-handed approach at a Saturday night vigil for a woman kidnapped and killed by an officer has been received with angry reactions on social media. Adidas Akhtiarzadeh from Hashtag Trending takes a look at some of the viral tweets.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another edition of Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. And today we're going to be talking about a boiling anger in Britain about the Metropolitan Police's harsh crackdown on people who are calling for justice for a woman who was killed by an officer. Stay tuned. People across Britain are stunned by a video that went viral showing London police using heavy-handed tactics to curb a vigil held for a slain woman. And guess what? The man accused of murdering Sarah Everard is a serving member of that very same police force. Check it out. Many have taken to social media to condemn the police violence. They have questioned the trust in the police that are meant to protect the people and not to kettle and pin them down forcibly like that. So let's get to the first comment on Twitter by Josh Ryan. It reads, how are women meant to report their abuse when this is the behavior they're met with at a vigil? These are the people meant to be trusted to protect these women. This behavior so close after one of their own murdered a woman is despicable. on to the next comment by Subi A. She wrote, looks like they've been taking notes from the American police. All right, let's check it out. And our next comment by Dr. Shola, it reads, this is misogynist violence by the Met police. Disgraceful conduct against women at a time we feel so vulnerable. Black and ethnic minorities have been telling you all about excessive use of force by institutionally racist British police. Pay attention. Other Twitter users have accused the police of brutality after the case of Sarah Everard, who was kidnapped and murdered by an officer. They are calling for the London police chief to resign. All right, our next tweet comes from Murad Nerali. It reads, the atmosphere here is incredible. Everybody in union for Sarah Everard, for women chanting, let her speak as police interfere. Okay, on to the next tweet by GRS. He says, I'm absolutely shocked and scunnered at what I'm seeing from London. The Metropolitan Police has a lot to answer for in their actions and inactions. Head of the Met should resign immediately as a first step. Imagine dragging women to the ground at a vigil for one murdered. Our next tweet comes from Observer 2021. It reads, UK is the worst place to live in as a woman. Sarah Everard, rest in peace. Police brutality in Sarah Everard vigil at a time when the UK is facing institutional racism, hashtag Oprah, Meghan, Harry, and worldwide demand to abolish the monarchy. Brexit Britain isn't helping either. Now, a lot of other people have tweeted about their concerns regarding police response to sexual harassment. An opinion poll by UN Women UK says only 4% of women report the incidents of sexual harassment to official organizations, while others believe the reportings don't even help change anything. Now, our next tweet comes from Mark McDougall. It reads, today is a good day to remind people how Tories treat women. Now on to our final tweet by Daniel Leal Olivas. He says, protesters calling for greater public safety for women after the death of Sarah Everard and against the police. No justice, no peace. Well, thanks for sticking around until the end of this edition. That's been it for me. Let's get back to the studio, and I'll see you all next time.
New reports show that British Muslims have been suffering from negative impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic at disproportionately high levels. What are the reasons behind this, and how can this pressing problem be remedied?
COVID-19 pandemic has been negatively affecting minorities in the UK, especially the British Muslims. The coronavirus outbreak has caused hardships for a record number of Muslims in the country, with the faith group experiencing a fall into poverty at a much higher rate than the rest of the British population. Also, the demand for help among them has doubled within a year. According to the National Zakat Foundation and Islamic Relief UK, requests for financial help have risen from about 15 per day before the first lockdown measures were introduced in the country to over 70 per day toward the end of 2020. The National Zakat Foundation says it has offered £3.8 million in grants. The figure represented a 27% increase compared to the previous year. The charitable organization offers such grants from Zakat, the obligatory religious levy collected from British Muslims.
Day in, day out, Muslims are being attacked on media by politicians of all persuasion, you know, left, right, and you know, every aspect of their lives is being associated with terrorism, with negativity, and this has an impact. I mean, this will have impact both financially and psychologically on the Muslim community. even Muslim organizations are not really adhered or supported.
With the second Ramadan and lockdown fest approaching, the national charity says funds are still urgently needed to respond to the continuing high demand for help. With the vast majority of zakat typically given during Ramadan, the National Zakat Foundation is now urgently seeking funds to ensure they can meet the needs of the community in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, according to multiple reports from the British government and rights organizations, the mortality rate from the COVID-19 pandemic among blacks, Asians, and minority ethnic communities has been disproportionately higher than others. Considering that 90% of Muslims are from such backgrounds, it's logically assumed that the fatalities among the faith group were much higher compared to the rest.
New figures from the Muslim Census Organization reveal the community has been falling into poverty at a rate 10 times higher than the UK population. The report also revealed that job losses among British Muslims have been 6 times greater compared to the rest of the population since the pandemic began. It also showed that 42% of Muslims surveyed had used their savings to cover their expenses during the pandemic. This is compared to a recent study by AJ Bell, an investment company, which recorded that 30% of UK people have had to use their savings. As well as facing poverty, Muslim communities are especially vulnerable to coronavirus, as many live in extended households where elderly people and those with existing health conditions are most at risk. Key workers such as NHS staff and transport workers from these families also have the additional fear of catching the virus. But there are other factors involved, including health inequalities.
Muslims, due to Islamophobia, and they have become second-class citizens in their own countries, in Britain, France, Germany, and most of the Western world. And they are being discriminated. They are the first one to be fired. They are the last one to be hired.
Experts believe the problem with the UK's health system is that people aren't getting the information and support they need.
It's not something that is just happening last week or last month. It's been going on for a very long time, and nothing is being done about it. Governments, not only they're not making an attempt to stop it, they are, them themselves and the politicians are actually contributing to ever-increasing environment of hate against Muslims.
They say, as the pandemic comes to an end, the British government needs to reinvest in services that support people's health and ensure they're culturally and linguistically inclusive and accessible to people from all communities.
Beijing is shrouded in yellow dust as the biggest sandstorm in nearly a decade sweeps across the Chinese capital. The massive sandstorm has topped the already high air pollution and given the skies in Beijing an eerie shade of orange. Authorities have issued the second highest safety alert for the city. The local government has ordered schools to cancel outdoor sport and events while urging residents to stay inside where possible. Hundreds of flights have also been canceled. Chinese weather agencies say the sandstorm originated in China's northern neighbor, Mongolia, where it has left at least 6 people dead and more than 80 missing. According to the World Air Quality Index, Beijing's air quality has plummeted to hazardous levels. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. from the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Nowruz, the Iranians and Persian-speaking people's New Year, is a few steps away. Today I've come to the bazaar in order to buy the stuff needed for Nowruz. We in Iran hold detailed ceremonies on Nowruz, so stay with me to know more about these ceremonies. Setting haftin cloth is one of the most famous customs of Nowruz. Hours prior to the arrival of the new year, a cloth is spread on a table or on the floor with seven symbolic items, which in Farsi language start with the Farsi letter Sin, equivalent to English letter S. These elements include seed or apple, senjed or oyster, somag or sumac, sir or garlic, serke or vinegar, sabze, usually wheat grass grown in a dish, seke or coin, samanu or sweet food made from wheat germ, and sombol or hyacinth. Though some put sa'at or clock and sangak, a kind of Iranian bread, as the items of haftin cloth. Only seven items among these are enough to complete the haftin cloth. Meanwhile, Iranians tend to put other items such as a mirror, candle, the Noble Quran, a bowl of water with an orange floating in it, colored eggs, and traditional sweets and pastries, nuts, and green vegetables. The items vary slightly in different parts of the country. Each of these elements symbolize something meaningful, which include concepts like light, brightness, health, wealth, and bliss. I am now in the bazaar. How crowded it is. Oh, look at there. It's Haji Firuz. Haji Firuz is a popular character who oversees the New Year's festivities by singing cheerful songs and playing a tambourine. The echo of Haji Firuz songs in Iran's streets and alleys heralds Nowruz and the new Iranian year. I am now in a herbal store. I'm going to buy some sumac for my haftin cloth. I also have to buy some wideru for my grandma. Burning the seeds of wideru is one of the customs of Iranians, which is believed to fend off diseases and brings about health. Oh, amazing! Someone is burning the wideru out of the store. What a pleasant scent. And I am now in a samanu making store. Samanu is a type of food which is made by wheat germ. It's sweet and very delicious. At the time of Nowruz, Iranian families make samanu all together or along with relatives or even with their neighbors. Making samanu is quite hard and time-taking. Therefore, I prefer to buy it ready-made. Succeeded in buying the items of Pepsin Club. Garlic, vinegar, samanu, sumac, and the hyacinth. Oh, well, I have grown the sabze myself since last week, and I have some coins. Now my half scene is complete.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Documents expose how major news outlets like the BBC and Reuters were contracted by the British government to push an anti-Russian narrative and further British interests inside Russia and in its neighboring countries. Many of these materials were marked confidential by Her Majesty's government, hoping they'd never see the light of day and that no one would publicly scrutinize them. Well, that's exactly what we're going to do. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. For several years now, we've constantly heard allegations in the media of how Russia has been spreading fake news and disinformation and manipulating social media sites and running troll farms and even journalists to meddle in the political affairs of the United States, the United Kingdom, and their allies. Well, it turns out the United Kingdom has been doing precisely that to Russia. A little hypocritical, don't you think? In a package of leaked documents posted online by the hacker collective Anonymous, we learn how Britain's Foreign Ministry, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, or FCO, sought to spread anti-Russian propaganda and promote narratives that were favorable to Britain and its allies. Under the FCO's Counter-Disinformation and Media Development Program, the British government issued this invitation to tender, offering millions of pounds for contractors to allegedly develop a, quote, network of NGOs exposing disinformation, unquote. Stated as part of the program's broader goal is to weaken Russian influence in neighboring countries. One of the parties that responded with a bid is the Zinc Network, a collective which includes organizations like Bellingcat and the Institute for Statecraft. Bellingcat has previously denied receiving any funding or information from the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office, yet here we see Bellingcat bidding for a contract from none other than the FCO. And in 2018, they pushed this narrative, which the UK, France, and the US used as a pretext, as a justification to go and bomb Syria. How bizarre. These leaked documents also go on to show how BBC Media Action and the Reuters Thomson Foundation, which are supposed to be the non-profit charities of BBC and Reuters respectively, were also awarded contracts by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Despite the original announcement by the FCO stating that the program is supposedly open and no attempt should be made to disguise activity, the contract with Reuters, for example, clearly says otherwise and is marked confidential, as are many other documents, which seems a bit odd if you're allegedly trying to promote journalistic standards and ethics to be participating in a secret program with the British government. These documents show how all these various outlets were telling the FCO about the thousands of journalists and contacts that they possess across the world, as if they're somehow boasting how far they can spread propaganda on behalf of Her Majesty's government. This propaganda is a spiderweb, frankly, of synthetic media groups and fronts for British intelligence. And you may recall some of these names, some of these groups like Albany or perhaps the Integrity Initiative, which were also implicated in the British government's propaganda network against Syria, aiming to promote regime change through all these fronts like ARC and IncoStrat, who were also running the White Helmets. Yes, it's a lot to digest, and it's done that way on purpose so that no one knows what's going on and everything remains obfuscated. These news outlets, like Reuters and the BBC, they claim to have an independent editorial board and to be transparent and objective. Yet when it comes to their supposed nonprofits, I mean, there's nothing ethical going on here. Anyone could agree that all of these shady practices have nothing to do with upholding journalistic standards, to say the least. It's interesting to see how the British government is doing exactly what it's been accusing Russia of doing for years. Russophobia has always been an effective political tool, you know, accusing someone of working for the Russians or being a communist in order to smear them. This goes back to the days of the Cold War and the Red Scare and McCarthyism. However, ever since the 2016 U.S. presidential elections, when Donald Trump beat the D.C. establishment favorite, Hillary Clinton, we've heard nonstop whining from the media and politicians in the United States about this made-up Russian interference, Russiagate. And after Trump won, exorbitant amounts of time and resources were wasted on trying to prove that there was some kind of link between his campaign and Russia with the Mueller report and various other congressional reports that amounted to absolutely nothing. And this is not just in the United States, of course. This is also something that transpired and was carried over into the UK on the other side of the pond. This craze of supposed Russian meddling and disinformation also took root there. And that's no surprise. Wherever the United States goes, the UK follows. We saw former Prime Minister Theresa May decry alleged Russian interference in Britain's elections. They claimed the Russians had interfered in Brexit. They claimed the Russians had interfered in Britain's general elections, in the Scottish referendum even. And just like in the United States, the British government went and started various inquiries, providing an official stamp of approval on its conspiracy theory to blame Russia. Max Blumenthal published an article on the investigative journalism website, The Gray Zone, unpacking the contents of these leaked documents, the stated purposes, goals, and actors involved in these anti-Russian propaganda networks that were cooked up by the British government. And if the contents weren't explosive enough, the article garnered even more attention after Twitter put a warning label underneath anyone who posted it, stating that it may contain hacked materials, as if to say that it were somehow hazardous and to disincentivize people from reading it. Another clear attempt at censorship just because the article, the story, doesn't suit the narratives of Western governments. How surprising. Now, the hypocrisy, frankly, couldn't be clearer. You know, one need only look at other news stories involving leaked documents from other governments, particularly in countries the UK and the US do not like, which received no warning label from Twitter. You can go and post them right now. There will be no warning on them. And just recently, for example, The Intercept published a story which supposedly included leaked documents from the Chinese government. There's no warning label on their tweet when they share the article. We don't even know if these documents are real. It doesn't matter. They can post them without any form of censorship or impediment. The Intercept has also published alleged documents containing hacked cables from Iran. Is there any so-called fact-checking to check if they're real? Or if they are real, was there any warning label on them about hacked materials? Of course not. It's so evident that these big tech and social media giants, who are a main source of news for many Americans and Westerners, they have a double standard. They want to enjoy the privilege of being treated as a platform so that they can't be held accountable for anything people post there, while also performing the activities of a publisher who picks and chooses what to release. And not only that, they also apply another double standard towards news stories that are adversarial to governments that the West is at odds with, while limiting and censoring journalists that question Western narratives and imperialism. Max Blumenthal, journalist and founder of The Gray Zone, who unpacked the contents of these latest FCO leaks, showing how the British government contracted media outlets to sow anti-Russian dissent and pro-NATO sentiment, joins me now to talk more. Thanks for coming on the show, Max. Good to have you on.
Thanks for inviting me on.
So, Max, I'll start out with the obvious one here. You know, we've been told for years that it's Russia who's meddling in other countries and in Western democracies and their affairs. And you look at these FCO documents, and turns out everything they accused Russia, they're doing. What do these documents tell us exactly?
Yeah, you said it perfectly. The British state, which really is acting as this sort of frontline proxy for Washington here in the new Cold War containment strategy against Russia, is doing everything that it accuses Russia of doing. This is all confirmed. We have the hard details, and this is only a scintilla of what it's probably doing. This is just what we know. And there are hundreds of documents here. I focused on the ones that revealed Reuters through its charitable nonprofit arm, the Thomson Reuters Foundation, and the BBC through its nonprofit arm, BBC Media Action, as well as smaller self-styled independent outlets like Bellingcat and Medusa, as essentially intelligence contractors for the British Foreign Office. And, you know, if you look at the whole scope of the documents, they're all focused on trying to counter and squelch Russian media that supports the national interests of the Russian government and the Russian state. And they're focused not only internally inside Russia, but also in Russia's near abroad, in the Baltics, Ukraine, Central Asia. They're using not only smaller media outlets and these major media organizations like Reuters, which is the largest media organization in the world. They're also creating family-oriented theatrical events in public parks in the Baltics, or soap opera, TV dramas, all sorts of programming to weaponize their media prowess, funded all by the British Foreign Office, to basically hack the brains of the Russian-speaking population within Russia's sphere of influence and affect attitudinal changes. We constantly saw these phrases in the documents, attitudinal changes to make them more pro-NATO. So what Reuters focused on was Russian journalists and bringing Russian journalists over to the UK, funded by the British Foreign Office through tours, and it was all kind of covert. The contracts that I published at the Grayson, they're marked secret, confidential, classified.
Yeah. They're engaging in secrecy. There's a covert element to what they're doing, right? They're trying to hide what's going on. And, I mean, isn't that a bit odd considering they're allegedly promoting unbiased journalism and ethics?
Well, in the 60s and 70s, Reuters ran a program for the MI6, British Foreign Intelligence, to produce anti-Soviet media in Latin America and to brand it as kind of independent. It was exposed because the documents were declassified, and Reuters came out and said, we don't do this anymore. This was all in the past. It was a Cold War thing. We refer you to our trust principles, which pledge independence and editorial integrity. And what these documents show here is that they are doing the same exact thing, the same program is in play, and that they've lied. So they have worked to keep these programs secret. One document reveals Thomson Reuters, in its bid to the British Foreign Office, describing how well it kept secret a delegation of Russian journalists to the UK during the Sergei Skripal poisoning intrigue. And they said, Reuters said, we were coordinating constantly with the British Embassy in Moscow to keep this under wraps. And as I mentioned, the contracts between Reuters and the British Foreign Office are marked private and confidential. So they obviously didn't want the British public to know that they're doing this. They certainly don't want the Russian government or Russian public to know about this. And they boast about creating a network of 400 journalists inside Russia. And I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg of what these documents reveal.
So, I mean, if you recall in 2020, YouTube said it's going to be banning videos that contain hacked materials. And, you know, Twitter is citing this hacked materials policy when they censored the Hunter Biden story by the New York Post and locked their account. And now this term, hacked materials, resurfaces as a label under your article. Where do you think they're going with this ultimately?
Well, just straight up censorship. With the Twitter label, what so many young people saw, who are ideologically unmoored, was that somebody who just simply went out and told the truth got soft censored. And what they see with Julian Assange, if they learn about that, is that someone who simply went out and published true facts was tortured and disappeared. So the idea that we have this liberal society where the truth can prevail and that the society can still be resilient enough and maintain its own national security and advance its national interests while there is a free discourse and citizens are able to criticize their government, that whole veneer has been completely ripped off by these episodes. And it just gets, it's like an onion that just keeps getting peeled away and peeled away until we reach the core, which is just this rotten, festering orb of cynicism and crude, raw power. And I think we're very close to that core right now.
Max Blumenthal, thank you so much for your time. It's great having you on. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast by IRIB English Radio.
Chris Williamson, former member of Parliament and close ally of Jeremy Corbyn, attempted to scrutinize these very same programs, particularly the Institute for Statecraft and its integrity initiative, after it targeted Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party at the time, smearing him as a, quote, useful idiot from Moscow, unquote. As a member of Parliament, he submitted a question to Alan Duncan, who at the time was the deputy to Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson. Williamson was inquiring about the nature of these programs, but was stonewalled repeatedly on grounds of national security. Chris joins me now. Thanks for taking the time to come on the show.
No, thanks for inviting me back, Richard. Good to be here.
So, Chris, we've been hearing for years now that it's Russia that's, you know, running all these disinformation campaigns and meddling in the U.S. and U.K. affairs. And it seems now from these FCO leaks that we're doing that in other countries. As a matter of fact, to Russia specifically. I mean, isn't that a bit, you know, hypocritical of us?
Very hypocritical. And I think the political class and the establishment in Britain are guilty of hypocrisy and hyperbole in equal measure. And, you know, Russia may very well be seeking to promote its interests through engaging in an information war. I don't know. There's, as I say, a lot of hyperbole about it. But what is absolutely certain is that we know that the Foreign and Commonwealth Office are engaged in a very significant information war effort, aided and abetted by the so-called independent British Broadcasting Corporation and, of course, Reuters, the biggest media organisation anywhere in the world. And, you know, this goes against the kind of whole ethos, allegedly, of Reuters, who, when they were exposed after papers were revealed under the kind of 30-year rule when cabinet papers are put into the public domain, and it came out that they'd been working hand in glove with the British state to, you know, engage in a propaganda offensive against the former Soviet Union. They were, you know, very apologetic about that and regretful and said, you know, this goes against our ethos and we certainly don't do anything like that today. And yet we now know from this latest revelations that's precisely what they are doing. And it's pretty shocking, really. And, you know, it just sort of shows the real double standards that are at play here.
So, Chris, there's a video of you in 2019 when you were trying to uncover what's going on. You went and confronted, actually, the Institute for Statecraft at their headquarters in London and even went to Scotland. Can you tell us what you found out about the Institute for Statecraft, their integrity initiative, and, you know, how the government was essentially trying to stonewall you and block you from finding out what was going on?
Yeah, well, I mean, when the kind of hacktivist group Anonymous put a lot of documents into the public domain, which exposed the activities of the Institute for Statecraft and one of their projects called the Integrity Initiative, I started asking questions because, excuse me, within those papers, it was revealed that they were engaged in a propaganda offensive against the leader of the Labour Party and some other key figures at a senior level inside the party, which at that time, of course, was promoting a socialist programme at home and an anti-imperialist agenda in terms of its foreign policy. And of course, this was unconscionable to the establishment, to the military-industrial complex, to the Zionist lobby. And so there were a lot of powerful forces obviously ranged against it. And so I started to ask some questions because it became apparent from these papers that they were attacking Jeremy Corbyn, smearing him, using social media platforms to do that. And discovered through a series of parliamentary questions that the Foreign Commonwealth Office and the Ministry of Defence had awarded the Institute for Statecraft and its Integrity Initiative in the previous 18 months alone in excess of £2 million. However, when I sought to get further information about their activities, they clammed up and said that this would undermine the effectiveness of the programme, citing national security and a whole manner of other ridiculous excuses. So I then took it upon myself to try and find out a little bit more information directly from the organisation and went to Scotland to their registered office, only to find that it's a semi-derelict former paper mill at the end of a half-mile dirt track. I mean, you couldn't make it up, really. They do have offices in London, and as you mentioned, I did go and try to seek some information from the people there. And a chap who... one of the founders of the Institute for Statecraft, Dan Lafayette, opened the door to me. And when I introduced myself and said I was Chris Williamson, MP for Derby North, had got some questions about their activities, he unceremoniously slammed the door in my face. I did try to shout a few questions through the closed door. And the thing about the Institute for Statecraft is that they have a range of what they refer to as clusters, journalists, tame journalists and academics, not just in Britain, but throughout Europe and around the world. And their alleged aim is to counter, you know, Russian disinformation. But it is interesting that, you know, this outfit is getting that level of support and the involvement of the BBC and, as I've said, Reuters. It is very, very troubling. And it's just the double standards which gets me. Russia is held up as this bogeyman, and yet the UK is engaged in far more intense sort of information war activities than anything that Russia's ever done. And I just think that's really worrying.
So these government programs, I mean, they're not just for foreign affairs in Russia, its neighboring countries, in Syria, but also at home in the UK, right? Because if they were smearing Jeremy Corbyn, the former Labour leader and leader of the opposition, you know, that means they're going after dissidents or opponents or people they don't like or people who are considered perhaps anti-establishment inside the UK, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, certainly that was one of the main reasons why, of course, I started to ask questions about what their activities, because they were using public money to attack the leader of the official opposition in the UK. And, that is an attack on our democracy, it seems to me. And that's why I was calling for a public inquiry. But, of course, you see, the agenda that Jeremy Corbyn was spearheading was one which threatened the status quo. It threatened the huge profits that were being made from the military industry, the defence industry in this country. And of course, it threatened the sort of foreign policy of Britain, the kind of consensus that there's been amongst parties, both parties, really ever since the war in terms of its attitude towards Israel. But we had in Jeremy Corbyn somebody who was a very strong anti-imperialist, somebody who was a big supporter of the Palestinian cause, somebody who had, criticised the Israeli state, the Israeli regime, demanded that they comply with their international law obligations. And therefore, he was, it seems to me, seen as a legitimate target, because that would have indeed called into question the UK's role in supporting Israel and supporting the hugely profitable arms industry in this regime. That obviously was something that they weren't prepared to countenance. And of course, it went further than that, because Jeremy was somebody And the agenda that he was putting forward, of course, gave us hope that we could turn the page on the neoliberal consensus that has caused so much despair and created so much poverty in Britain, the fifth biggest economy in the world, where we have 14 million people living in poverty. And had that opportunity, I think, you know, over time, the Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn would have indeed done that. And that's why I think that, you know, they targeted him. They targeted him because of his domestic policy and obviously his foreign policy. These were things which were, you know, by these very powerful vested interests that couldn't be allowed to stand. And they did everything they could, therefore, to stop them, including using public money to go after, as I say, the leader of the official opposition in the country. As I say, this goes to the root, it goes to the core of what our democracy is supposed to be about. I mean, you know, it's almost incredible. If you read it in a screenplay before you know, these documents came into the public domain, you'd say, well, that's all very interesting, but it would never happen in real life. But of course, you know, often truth is stranger than fiction, and here's a case in point.
The hypocrisy of the British government and these supposed NGOs and news outlets that they've cooperated with is frankly stunning. You know, they claim to be fighting disinformation while spreading disinformation themselves. It's just plain old propaganda. And no less from establishments like the BBC and Reuters and others who claim to be superior and claim to uphold journalistic standards. For years, we've heard nothing but anti-Russian propaganda from these very same outlets and fear-mongering about Russian interference from lawmakers on both sides of the pond and virtually every mainstream media outlet reporting that as fact. And yet now, when we have a story of the exact same caliber with official government documents proving that the United Kingdom has been doing the exact same thing, complete silence. The media can't even be bothered to report on these explosive revelations of the United Kingdom meddling in the affairs of foreign countries and major news outlets cooperating with them, abdicating their journalistic ethics and standards, as if they ever had any to begin with. Moreover, we see clearly once again how Silicon Valley, how all these tech giants and social media companies are just an extension of the government and a tool used to manipulate public opinion and control reporting that is adversarial to interests of the West. It's an extension of the national security state. Again, is it deplorable? Absolutely. Are we surprised? Not really. We know that these practices have been going on for decades since the Cold War. Regime change and propaganda, these are Britain and America's strong suits and a habit that they can't seem to kick. They continue these Cold War practices while pointing the finger at Russia and accusing Russia of the very same things that they decry. You couldn't find a stronger case of the pot calling the kettle black. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.